Just in our neck of the woods, it's been a busy month in the media. Our listeners demonstrated a commitment to public radio in the region with a hugely successful fund drive. While that was going on, movie makers and movie fans descended on Ashland for the Ashland Independent Film Festival. Elsewhere, this year's Pulitzer Prize winners were announced, so there's plenty to talk about in media, as in news and not, in our monthly installment of Signals and Noise, an omnivorous banquet of happenings in the media. Our guests come from the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Joining Andrew Gay this month is Christopher Lucas. Good to have you both here, Christopher and Andrew.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start with documentary films, because you guys apparently were living from what you just said a few moments ago at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. So is it not just my impression, but that there are, in fact, more documentaries getting made in the world today?
I would imagine so. I mean, I'm one of the programmers of the Ashland Independent Film Festival, and obviously our festival is very focused on documentary. We do narrative features as well, and shorts and all of that, expanded cinema. But the documentaries really are our strength, and we had a really great program this year. And definitely this year, there's kind of a undercurrent of activist documentary, people really using documentary techniques to confront power, confront injustice, those kinds of things.
Is that because is there a thought that there's a vacuum, that this is not something that the commercial TV networks are going to take over anymore?
Well, you know, I saw one doc that very much took that track. It was Whose Streets, and I forget the director's name right now, but it covered the Ferguson situation. And you know, the cinematographer, his name was Lucas, I forget his last name, was in here in Ashland and did the Q&A. And he talked about the fact that, you know, the networks covered one perspective. The networks really gave, you know, the official word, you know, the responses from the police department, from the mayor, where they didn't do as great a job as embedding themselves and really understanding the people. And that's what this documentary did. And so they flat out said, you know, the mainstream media from their perspective was not covering the story from all sides. So we're not going to cover the story from all sides. We're going to give the other side that wasn't shown. So that was interesting.
That film in particular is a great example of why there's so many more, or seem to be so many more, documentaries these days, because that film really constructed out of a lot of footage shot in the moment, people's, you know, cell phones, low resolution cameras, and sort of built into a really dynamic, interesting, visually interesting piece of cinema. So I think both our tolerance for a variety of different looks really has made documentary a really exciting place aesthetically, but also just the low cost and easy availability of these really high quality imaging devices and recording devices. You know, it's a whole new world for that reason.
I mean, my wife's a professional photographer. She lugged around two Nikon bodies and a bunch of lenses for years, and her phone looks better than anything she shot back then now.
Totally.
Which brings up an interesting point, though, about documentaries. I was thinking about this in the context of the incident aboard United Airlines this week, when a passenger was taken off and basically ripped out of the plane with people screaming. But they weren't just screaming. They were also recording. Mm-hmm. In the years before everybody had a video camera in their hands all the time, you'd have to take people's words for what happened aboard that plane, with some people saying one thing and some people seeing it differently. But now it's right there for everybody to see, which must make documentary filmmaking a very different kind of game.
For sure. I mean, you know, that never would have been a story, right? Without mobile imaging devices like, you know, your cell phone camera and Twitter, right?
Errol Morris has did a great series of discussions and op-eds in the New York Times a couple of years ago, where he actually talks about this quite a bit, and specifically how, you know, we really got into this age where there's so much visual evidence all over the place, but that can also be misleading, right? Because we see what looks like an apparent evident truth in front of us of some terrible thing or injustice, and clearly the United Airlines story was terrible and an injustice, but at the same time, can just as easily be used for manipulation, right? And this was his point. There's plenty of evidence over the last 20 years of people using what seems like self-evident visual evidence to make an argument that turns out to be, you know, essentially false.
Well, right. even when you get a shocking clip, too, I mean, as has been demonstrated a few times, if there's no context to it, if you don't know what happened in the 25 seconds before the 50 you saw, you might not fully understand what happened.
That's the risk with citizen journalism. I think citizen journalism is fantastic. I'm all for it. At the same time, we no longer have the full investigative reporting, the commentary, the editorial oversight that happens, right? So it can be misleading. It can be dangerous.
This is our Signals and Noise segment, our monthly perusal of things going on in the media. And this is not just news media, but media writ much larger. Andrew Gaze, our regular representative from the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Christopher Lucas steps in this month. He's on the part-time faculty at SOU. And you can join us at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Christopher, I want to talk to you about funding documentaries because you are a consultant and a grant writer for Doc Films, I understand.
That's right.
And so how big a business is that to try to drum up money for documentary projects?
You know, well, I kind of fell into this in some way because I'm a documentary maker myself and do a lot of grant writing and have been part of several crowdfunding campaigns. And you really realize that the kind of skills and energy needed to do a successful crowdfunding campaign does not really fit well with being an artist and a filmmaker. So I ended up doing a lot of this work for my friends, and then this transitioned into more kind of formal consulting. Seems like there's a lot of work to be done, whether these folks are often really scraping together and trying to do films on subjects that don't necessarily attract a lot of money or they don't have a lot of resources themselves. So I would never call it a big business, but it's really rewarding, and I really have an opportunity to get engaged in these projects very early and learn where the story's going and help kind of give input on the story. Because what you really realize is, the process of making a documentary is kind of epic. It takes a lot of sense of mission and a willingness to follow the story where it goes.
And to shoot hours and days and weeks and sometimes
Absolutely.
Months and maybe
these
even
are
years
long commitments.
So where do people go though for funding? I mean, what are some of the logical sources if they don't want to do the crowdfunding route, do the Indiegogo thing?
Well, there's the private foundation world is out there. The competition is fierce for the limited range of film grants, of which there are several pretty large film grants. Sundance has become the Sundance Film Festival, and Sundance Institute has become a really important player in that space. And a lot of other groups like MacArthur and Ford are working closely with Sundance to kind of pull together the funding mechanisms and make it easier for documentary filmmakers to apply. So those kinds of film grants are very popular to apply for. But if you have a documentary that's about a particular subject, you can also search for foundations that are working in that service area, right? If it's homelessness or hunger or sort of race relations or what have you, there's a lot of foundations who are very specifically focused in their issue portfolio on those directions. So we target those.
I've seen, we're seeing a lot of crowdfunding as well, though. Mm-hmm. I noticed most of the docs that I watched at Ashland this year, as the credits rolled, they had the longest part of the credits were all the backers from crowdfunding campaigns. I've run crowdfunding campaigns for a documentary. Chris is running one now. I think that crowdfunding is really a powerful tool to connect with the audience that's concerned in your issue, especially for documentary, because if you're covering an issue that is important to a community, crowdfunding gets you to bring in that community. Again, it ties into that sort of activist thing. It's not necessarily that you're the documentary filmmaker trying to be this objective storyteller. Maybe you're trying to tie into a community and tell their story and get them to help you fund that.
I would say the film industry itself is entirely at least the documentary side, even maybe to some extent the narrative side, has basically absorbed, has integrated the reality of crowdfunding and Kickstarter in particular at this point, where if you go out to festivals, you go to talk to distributors, they're like, how was your Kickstarter? how many people did you, how many people donated? How big is your list? That you kind of want to know, have you already begun to build that audience of really fierce fans?
So, but how are documentaries distributed? I mean, obviously, you guys were both involved with the Ashland Independent Film Festival, and so lots of documentaries there. But, I mean, so many things are also provided via YouTube and Vimeo and other places online.
Netflix.
So all sorts of places you can find stuff. So, I mean, there's a larger question here. Let's focus on documentaries for just a second, though. It's like, I mean, are documentaries, a lot of them, just not seeing the light of day? Or does everything see the light of day because there's just so many different places to put them out there?
Well, I mean, for sure, because media creation is more accessible than ever. We're getting more media created than ever, and obviously a lot of that gets unseen. That being said, the big story in distribution right now is Amazon, Netflix, YouTube, Facebook, Hulu, they are devouring the media from film festivals that the other distributors can't even compete with. These new online streaming platforms are becoming major players as distributors now. So a lot of documentary media is getting out there to a large audience through these platforms.
Really an on-demand kind of thing, though.
They're spending billions of dollars buying content. And it's a mixed bag, I think, for documentary filmmakers, because one thing you realize is you may be very able to find a platform to get your project out there, but then the new challenge is making people realize it's there, right? Because you can just disappear into the catalog, mm-hmm. especially Netflix, which mm-hmm. is millions of titles deep, and I don't think it's millions actually, but...
I don't know. Sometimes when you're searching for something, it feels like
it. Yeah. So how do you get seen?
So we're talking, this is our monthly Signals and Noise segment with members of the Southern Oregon University Communications faculty. Andrew Gaze, the regular, Christopher Lucas is sitting in this month, and you can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So now the larger question then about finding not just documentaries, but any media, because one of the things we'll do at the end here is the pick threes mm-hmm. about your three favorite media items for the last month. How do you decide? I mean, there's such a broader field than there used to be before the internet and streaming and Twitter and all that stuff. I mean, there's just so much stuff out there that you can lay your fingers on.
Yeah, I joke that I don't actually watch Netflix. I, you know, allot an hour to search Netflix every night. You know, no, that's not what I want tonight. Oh, well, that looks good, but I'll add it to my list and I'll look at it later. And I never actually end up watching anything. It's really hard. You have to, I think, you know, mostly what I watch because other people suggest it to me. They say, you have to see that. So that's why I think social media is so important in terms of, you know, if you're a maker, getting people to know about your work and building that network. That's why crowdfunding helps, because if you already have an audience, they can spread the word. So I think really word of mouth is so important.
Yeah, word of mouth. I think also, you know, clearly these platforms are also attempting to choose for us, right? When you go to Netflix,
you must like this.
It's got a menu, right? Mm-hmm. So there's algorithms directing things to us. And I always try to encourage people to get past the algorithm, you know, kind of take a deep dive, search for mm-hmm. stuff, watch something unusual and see what happens to the selections that start to pop up, which can be fascinating. Yeah, because, you know, it's really easy to find yourself in a box. You know?
So let's talk about this year's Pulitzer winners, because they were announced this week, and a couple of really interesting things, including the fact that Sweat, a play that was premiered at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and, in fact, commissioned through the American Revolution's history cycle, won a Pulitzer for Lynn Nottage, the playwright. Actually, her second Pulitzer for drama, so kudos to her big time. What else do you see on this list that really stands out to you two guys, Andrew?
For me, it was David Fahrenthold's reporting for the Washington Post about Donald Trump's charitable givings. That was really an interesting process, because I followed David on Twitter, and throughout the entire process of his reporting, he was very transparent about where he was at, what he was doing, what methods he was using to get to the story, and all of that was on Twitter. So you saw this reporting in real time in a really interesting way that showed you how journalism works. And I think that was, one, an education in what's really going behind the scenes with Donald Trump, but also this is how journalism happens, and this is what real journalists do. It's not always super sexy. Sometimes it's, you know, calling up people and scratching names off a list one at a time.
So, well, this foundation did not get the funding that Trump promised,
right,
and this one didn't either, that sort of thing. What stands out to you on this list of Pulitzer winners, Christopher Lucas?
Well, I was really glad to see ProPublica get another Pulitzer. I think this is their third for their investigative work. And this is, you know, has some slight connection to our documentary conversation, because ProPublica is another, like JPR, a nonprofit, right? And so they're looking for new business models to support really quality journalism, and I really appreciate that. I was also really glad to see the local smaller papers get some love. A lot of people are talking about that editorial writing award for the Storm Lake Times in Iowa, very small Iowa
paper. Twice-weekly paper, yeah.
Right. But really, you know, going really directly after some kind of corporate government interlocks in that state and big agribusiness, and really standing out. I think also the fact that it was a kind of a surprise to see a category that's usually going to a bigger paper get this kind of attention.
I noticed the same thing with the investigative reporting, where the Charleston Gazette Mail in West Virginia got the investigative reporting Pulitzer for the coverage of the West Virginia opioid epidemic for Eric Iyer at the Charleston Gazette Mail. So kudos there. About 2 minutes left to get the pick threes for the month in. So Andrew Gay, why don't you go first?
All right. Well, speaking of accessible media, my first is actually a media device. It's called the Insta 360 Nano. Precious and I, next month, we want to talk about VR media because we're doing some work in that. The Insta 360 Nano is a little $200 camera device that attaches to an iPhone. They also have one called the Air that attaches to Android devices. And it does 360 virtual reality media. And it's designed to share directly to Facebook and YouTube and Periscope. It can live stream. It's a lot of fun, and I've been having a lot of fun with that. The next is a film that I saw at the film festival, a documentary called The Groove Is Not Trivial. It's about Alistair Fraser, a Scottish fiddler who is actually based in the Bay Area and is currently touring in our region. He's playing in Northern California and some in Oregon right around now. And it's just a really inspiring doc. Was very moved by it. And the third is actually Alistair Fraser's music. I've been listening to a lot of it on iTunes, and it's beautiful.
Okay, so two of your pick threes are Alistair Fraser involved. Christopher Lucas, what's your pick three for the month?
One is also a festival film, the film Dolores, which was kind of a biographical documentary about Dolores Huerta, who was one of the founders of the American Farm Workers Union, and just a fascinating and inspirational documentary and figure. I mention that because it's going to be coming out on PBS later in the year. I want people to keep an eye out for
Dolores,
it. And the filmmaker of that film recently moved to Ashland, so that's really exciting. Also really like The Chef's Table, which is a cooking documentary series on Netflix. And then final, a very unusual choice maybe, but popular in my house right now, is tinykittens.com, which is a a series of live, a nonprofit that rescues cats in Vancouver, BC, and they keep these live stream cameras on the mama kittens as they have babies, and it's just really charming.
You've just changed my daughter's lives, I think.
Absolutely. Tinykittens.com. Wow, one of many, many, many
my
places.
My wife tipped me off to that one.
Okay, that's our media discussion for the month on Signals and Noise. Christopher Lucas and Andrew Gay and the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Good to visit with you, and have a good month.
Thank you.
Thank you.